Why is there something rather than nothing? The philosopher Martin Heidegger called this the fundamental question in all of metaphysics. For scientists, the question might be put this way. How could our universe pop out of nothing nearly 14 billion years ago? Empty space one moment, then a second later, an exploding swirl of energy. Believe it or not, some scientists think we may finally have an answer, though a new book by Lawrence Krauss has sparked an intellectual brawl. Steve Paulson talked with Krauss and fellow physicist Marcelo Gleiser to find out what this modern creation story means for both science and religion.
This is a story about nothing and the beginning of everything and how nothing can become something. It's also a story about why some scientists think philosophers are useless, while others say certain scientists themselves have become arrogant and full of hubris. But before we go any further, we need to consider a basic question. What is nothing?
To a physicist, the first version of nothing that you might think of is just simply empty space with nothing in it. You get rid of all the particles, all the radiation, so there's literally nothing in it. But that nothing is actually quite complicated. Because of quantum mechanics and relativity, it turns out that empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles popping in and out of existence in a timescale so short you can't even measure them.
That's Lawrence Krauss, a theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Institute at Arizona State University. His idea of nothing is quite different from what you'd hear from a theologian or philosopher who's more likely to talk about non-existence or non-being.
That's true, but I don't exactly know what those words mean. It seems to me that nothing is a physical quantity just like something is, and we need to look to the universe to ask what it is. Now, from a physical point of view, one can get a little closer to that vague and, I would say, ill-defined version of non-being that philosophers and theologians might have argued about for thousands of years by saying, well, in fact, there are other versions of nothing, and in fact, you can imagine no space and no time, which, of course, I think is a better version of non-being and non-existence. But if we apply the laws of quantum mechanics to gravity, in that theory, even space itself can pop into existence spontaneously, space and time, where there were no space and time before. And boy, that's pretty close to what I think anyone would argue is nothing. But, you know, if it doesn't satisfy those who think that that's non-being, so be it. But I'm much more interested in the nothing of the actual universe than some vague a priori definition of what non-being is.
Lawrence Krauss has written a provocative book called A Universe from Nothing. It's an argument for how science can finally answer the age-old mystery of why there's something rather than nothing. Now, Krauss is quick to say he doesn't have definitive proof. He's offering a plausible explanation based on the latest science, which left me with a basic question.
Can you explain to a non-physicist how the universe can be created out of nothing?
Yeah, given what we understand about quantum gravity, about quantum mechanics and general relativity together, it is quite possible that literally a small space could pop into existence where there was none before. Normally, such spaces will pop in and out of existence in a timescale so short you can't measure them, and those universes will disappear quite quickly. But what is also remarkable is we have great evidence that in our universe, at very early times, and by very early, I mean something like a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, our universe puffed up by a huge amount. Energy got trapped in space, and that energy caused the universe to expand incredibly rapidly. We call that a period of inflation. And it sounds like a scam. How can you get something for nothing? How can you get a free lunch? Well, it turns out physics allows you to get a free lunch.
I guess what's so bizarre for the outsider, for the non-physicist here?
It's bizarre for me, too. But,
but it sounds like you're saying it's no big deal in the world of quantum physics for something to come out of nothing. For some reason, that's not a problem, when for the outsider, that seems like a huge problem.
In fact, it's not only not a problem. It would be the much more remarkable question would be, why is there nothing rather than something, except we wouldn't be around to ask the question, because nothing is essentially unstable. Empty space, due to the laws of quantum mechanics and gravity, is unstable. If you leave it long enough, it'll always create particles. So the real point is that that distinction, that common sense distinction between something and nothing, in common parlance, is not such a distinction in physics. It's due to the weird laws of quantum mechanics. And the really interesting questions in our universe is, how did it evolve and how did we get here? And this why question, which may have seemed so profound, has been replaced. And it often happens in science, I think, that questions that seem to have a certain type of significance the meaning of those words changes. And it's not a scam, and it's not something we do to defeat philosophers and theologians. We do it because we take our definitions from the universe.
I have to follow up on that, because there is that common saying that theology and philosophy deal with the why questions while science deals with the how questions, because the fundamental religious question, of course, is why are we here? Are you saying those why questions should not even be asked?
Well, I think most why questions are really how questions, because if you ask why, what you're really meaning is you're presuming purpose. You're making a presumption that there's some meaning, some purpose. And I would argue that if you insist on why, you're assuming the answer before you ask the question. You're assuming there is purpose to the universe and that there's some reason that we came to exist. But why should there be a reason? And why must there be purpose to the universe? It's science. We just try and figure out how it happened. There may be purpose to the universe, and science certainly can't answer that question ultimately in the negative. But what we can say is there's no evidence of purpose, that everything we see, as far as we can tell, came into existence by laws of physics that we can understand without any supernatural shenanigans. There doesn't have to be a reason, and that may disappoint some people, but in fact, I find it quite emboldening. So it energizes me to think that due to a set of accidents, remarkably, in this remote corner of a galaxy, in the remote corner of the middle of nowhere of our universe, in a remote planet, that we happen to evolve with a consciousness that can ask these questions, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun and realize that the meaning of our lives is the meanings we make from it.
Let me just follow up on that word meaning. I mean, basically, you're saying that, you know, we construct our own meaning, and it does raise the question of whether science is in the business of helping us find meaning, because, of course, again, that's traditionally the domain of religion and philosophy.
Well, I think what the last few thousand years have shown us is that the domain of religion and philosophy is shrinking. In fact, I would have argued that the domain of religion shrank to zero a long time ago. So I think what is amazing is because of the astounding and remarkable developments that have taken place in science, we are being pushed to the threshold of asking questions which we may not have thought were scientific questions initially or were the domain of science. But the domain of science is to understand the universe.
What's especially striking about Lawrence Krauss's book is how he's linked his theory about the origins of the universe to the new atheist movement. In fact, Richard Dawkins has written the afterword, claiming that Krauss has demolished the theological arguments in cosmology, just as Charles Darwin did in biology. And I will say, Krauss does not mince words when he talks about religious ideas about creation.
I don't write things to attack God because I don't think God's important enough to attack, frankly. I think what is amazing is understanding reality. Then this need for belief in myths and superstition will go away, and that's a good thing. The scriptures, the books of the world's great religions, were written by people who didn't even know the earth went around the sun. So how could they know anything about the world that's sensible?
Well, you are not just hard on religion and theology. Your book has also sparked a very public spat between physicists and philosophers. And at one point you say some of modern philosophy is intellectually bankrupt. Why are you so hard on philosophers of science?
Well, I don't believe we can make great progress understanding nature or even understanding ourselves by turning inward. I would go so far as to say we can only really claim to know things that we can empirically test. But unless we reflect on reality, then we're just playing mind games, in my opinion.
Okay, well, I have to ask you about that scathing review of your book in the New York Times Book Review by the philosopher of science, David Albert, who, it's worth pointing out, has a PhD in physics. And it comes back to
this. But he's not
this.
A physicist, he's a philosopher.
Right.
That's worth pointing out, too.
It comes back to this discussion of what nothing means. And he said, you have not answered the basic problem of something coming out of nothing because you don't explain where those quantum fields came from in the first place or why the laws of physics are the way they are. For instance, why we have quantum mechanics, why that even
exists. Yeah, I think he should
have
read the book before reviewing it. I think it would have helped that review immensely if he'd actually read more than the preface and the afterword.
His point is that you don't answer the core philosophical question, which is first cause.
Yeah, well, in fact, I try very carefully to say what I do and don't do. What he said is, Lawrence Krauss didn't write the book I would have liked to have written about some other subject. I actually do describe exactly how it's possible that quantum fields can come into existence. And if that's not the question he wanted answered, too bad.
But I guess the question, though, is don't there have to be laws of physics for any of this stuff to happen? And therefore, the something can come out of nothing?
Well, you know, it's a good question. However, people are driven to the idea now that, in fact, it may be that all laws of physics are possible, namely, that every different kind of law you could imagine might arise in some universe that might arise and exist for a microscopic instant or an eternity. And it's an interesting question we may not be able to resolve. As I say, if our universe is one of potentially an infinite number of universes, some of which are popping into existence right now, then we may indeed ask the question, why the multiverse?
Well, we're really talking about a modern creation story here. And the question that's on the table is whether science has finally come up with its own version of a creation story that once and for all replaces all those religious creation stories out there. And it would seem that there are ultimately two options. Either the universe appeared at some point in time, the first of the many multiverses, let's say, or it has existed forever. Would you agree that those are the two choices?
Absolutely. But I think the same is true of religion. I mean, let me point out that science is more than a story. And by the way, it has replaced the creation myths of religion. Long ago, it replaced those creation myths. But I would argue that, you know, the same questions that you could throw at science, is the multiverse eternal and why is it eternal? God is just an intellectual cop-out for lazy minds. They basically say, look, that fundamental question of how it came into existence is so difficult, I'm going to assume some incredible intelligence. And by the way, I won't even ask the question, how did that incredible intelligence come into being? I'll just say it had to be around forever because I can't have any other explanation. It seems to me that that's just intellectually lazy.
So getting back to these two choices, this gets very speculative, of course, because we don't really know whether we're in a multiverse or not. But would you believe that there was one original universe, whether it's ours or another universe, or whether this has just been going on forever?
Well, first of all, I don't like to use the word believe. I don't think it's a relevant word for science. But everything I know about science suggests that, in fact, there probably is an eternal multiverse of which our universe is a part. So my best guess is, in fact, the multiverse is eternal, but certainly our universe popped into it.
Well, there's another question here as well. Is the universe ultimately knowable? Because it would seem that one very legitimate response for both a scientist and an atheist would be to say, no, there will be some fundamental mysteries beyond the capacity of science to explain.
Well, there may be. I mean, as you know, I wrote a book about Richard Feynman, and Feynman would say, you know, maybe the laws of physics are like an onion. You just keep peeling back, and there are infinite number of layers, and we never, you know, have a theory of everything. And that could be the case. But that makes life even more fascinating, it seems to me, than presuming that you know everything by saying that God exists. That's just boring and tedious.
As you might imagine, Lawrence Krauss is catching lots of flack from religious thinkers and philosophers, and also from some fellow scientists. For a different take on cosmology and spirituality, I turned to Marcelo Gleiser, a physicist at Dartmouth College who writes for NPR's science blog, 13.7. Gleiser recently blogged about the flap over Krauss's book, noting what he calls its triumphant tone that science will conquer all. Gleiser himself is far more cautious.
We have no answers to three very fundamental questions: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of consciousness. Now, it is very possible that we will understand consciousness and life because these are things that, in a sense, are within our control. I mean, you can run lab experiments with these things. But the origin of the universe is a really complicated question. It really kind of defies the very core of what science is. And I do not know how we could possibly understand it, because even if you make a model like Hawking made models and people made models of a quantum creation of the universe, you still have all these implicit assumptions in there, which is you're using conservation of energy, you're using general relativity, you're using quantum mechanics. So you can always ask, okay, but where do these laws come from? So you have to go beyond science and create a kind of a meta-science, which is explaining why science works the way it does. And we don't have that. And we don't even know how to come to grips with that. And so maybe there are questions that are unknowable. And if that's true, you have to accept that and be humbled by it and say, look, there's all this wonderful stuff we can explain about the world. We just do not need to explain everything.
I went to see Marcelo Gleiser at his Dartmouth office, where we talked about his book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. Gleiser believes his own field of physics has been seduced by the so-called search for everything, a single beautiful theory that would unify all of physics. Elaborate mathematical models have led many physicists to embrace string theory and the multiverse, which so far have no empirical proof.
Even though this is a very compelling idea, the notion that there is this kind of hidden explanation for all that exists in the world, and in fact, it's an idea that completely seduced me in my own career, you know, I started to realize that it was becoming extremely convoluted. We're not getting any closer to this. And in fact, all of the unifying ideas in physics are really more approximations than a true, pristine unity. Those unifications we talk about in physics, they are not perfect unifications. They always have a little flaw. And I start to realize that perhaps, you know, we are pursuing the wrong dream.
Gleiser says there's a curious precedent for the scientist's obsession with a single explanation for everything. As he was studying the history of science, he came to think this idea comes straight out of monotheistic religion.
And I think that intellectually, the search for a unification of nature is really a rationalization of the notion of God. It's sort of a way of thinking about God through the tools of science.
I have to say, I think highly regarded physicists like Steven Weinberg or Brian Greene would be horrified that there's anything religious about what they're trying to do, because, of course, they're big advocates of trying to find a theory of everything. What makes this religious, this search?
Well, you have to take religion here in a very broad sense. I'm not saying that superstring theory is a religious theory, God forbid. I'm an atheist. I have to distinguish. I'm an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. So that is not my point at all. What I mean is that this notion that nature is one and all is one is a notion that is much older than, you know, Galileo and Newton and all those guys. Now, talking about Einstein, he used to call science the most honest of all religions, in a sense, that what motivates a scientist is this cosmic religious feeling. What does he mean by that? Well, he means this kind of awe with the mysterious. And the way to peer into that darkness is through human reason and intuition, this devotion, you know, this sort of idea that you can give your life to understand this mystery is, in essence, a very religious choice.
Well, that raises the question of whether you think that the universe is ultimately knowable. I mean, the great scientific pursuit, is it knowable, or are you comfortable saying it's not and that there will always be mystery there and that's okay?
That is exactly right. We can know about the world through science, and the way we understand reality is through our measurements, our tools. And our tools, even though they are wonderful and even though they are advancing, they have limits, and they will always have limits. So you can measure things to a certain precision, you can measure things to a certain distance, but beyond that, you have darkness, you do not know.
But I think the response of a lot of scientists would be, yes, there are many things we don't understand right now. We don't understand what dark matter is, what dark energy, all kinds of things. We don't understand how the mind, where, you know, the connection between brain and mind. But science is all about trying to figure out that understanding, and to say that we'll never be able to understand it is defeatism, scientific defeatism.
Right, and I have heard that before, and I have corrected the critics by saying that is not what I mean. What I mean is precisely the opposite. I think that science is an eternal pursuit of knowledge, that there is no end to the quest. So what I'm concerned about is this sort of excess of confidence on the part of certain scientists to say that, yes, there is a final theory of nature and that we can get to it. I think that is incredibly arrogant, and it does a disservice to what science really is trying to do, which is to give meaning to our lives, ultimately.
Do you think this is a spiritual position, to say that ultimately the universe is unknowable in some final sense, that there will always be mystery there?
Yes, I think it's a deeply spiritual position. And in fact, I think there is nothing wrong with this sort of reconciliation between science and spirituality. In fact, I would even propose a different definition of sacred, right? Because in a sense, what people, at least traditionally, what the sacred is a place where you are not where you were before. It's a place where you have to pay attention, so to speak. You know, so you go into a temple And if you're not a religious person, but you're John Muir, you go to a forest and you're going to say, this is my temple, this is my sacred spot, right? And within that notion of the sacred, there's this very subjective feeling of awe with the mystery of what we do not know. And to me, the main sort of engine behind scientific inspiration is precisely this seduction of the unknown. And so if I now place what is sacred on the parts of the universe that I do not understand, then the pursuit of science becomes the pursuit of the sacred.
Marcelo Gleiser is a physicist at Dartmouth College. Steve Paulson also talked with Arizona State University physicist Lawrence Krauss.